Good morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing. This is hearing screen 8, dealing with business zones, and I have sitting with me at this hearing screen Commissioner Rogers from Christchurch and Commissioner Lawton, a political ward councillor. Now we're going to hear first from the council in respect of memorandum during the stages 1 and 2.
Thanks, Sir. Good morning. Up here with Ms. Scott for the council. Our witness team is lined up behind us in terms of the order of witnesses. I understand you've been advised of that.
Yes.
Any issues with that proposed order, sir?
Well, I haven't been advised of the order.
Oh, I see.
Unless it was in the back of this memo, which I didn't quite finish.
This is in the back of the submission, sir, but I can advise you now of the intended order if you wish to take notes. First of all, Dr. Childs on plastic matters, Mr. Timothy Church on urban design matters, followed by Mr. Tim Heath on retail and business issues, Jackie Gillies, Heritage, and I think today we will probably get through Ms. Sharon Swinney as well on sale and supply of alcohol matters.
So you're proposing to switch the over, are you?
Yes, sir. And just depending upon how quickly we track through as possible, we may start one of Ms. Jones' matters today, I suspect, but again.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping we can deal with the first thing, no reason.
Yes, all right. So I'm happy to answer any questions the panel has about the memorandum. This is a bad forewarning as to what they are, but I'll do my best to answer them. If I can't answer them, I'll hand it over to Ms. Scott.
Yes, okay. Paragraph 7.1, we talk about chapters 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6 being applicable across both volumes A and B. I just couldn't find in the resolution where the council has committed to that.
You're correct, sir. It hasn't made that resolution. It is rather, and it's questionable as to what effect a resolution saying that would have. Really, it's rather the strategic approach, which was advised to you in the initial hearings, was that those strategic directions chapters would be overarching and apply district-wide. And given that they contain only objectives and policies and not rules, then the position is of the council that from an interpretational and structural perspective, that is a workable approach, but you're correct, there's no resolution to that.
I'm just wondering, though, if the council has resolved to deal with the plan in two geographic areas, and volume A being geographic area A, volume B, and volume A is essentially the area that the proposed district plan stages 1 and 2 applies to, and volume B is the area that the operative plan continues to apply to. I'm having difficulty understanding how
there can be any legal connection between provisions that apply in Area A to an operative plan applying in Area B. And I raise this because there are implications in the strategic directions chapters as to the application of rules, and there may be inconsistencies between what they say and what the operative district plan says. Landscape being the obvious one, but of probably of lesser importance given that all the rural area is in volume A, but then the landscape section in the operative plan is written in such a way that applies, seems to apply everywhere in the district.
Yes. Well, I can answer the question in, I suppose, a couple of ways. Firstly, there was always an appreciation from the officers and consultants that were working on the proposed plan that some parts would be excluded. Nevertheless, when they were formulating the strategic chapters, it was always on the basis that that there was that understanding that those excluded parts would fit into the overall operative plan once this review was completed. And as a matter of law, when this review is completed and the proposed parts of the plan become operative and join those other parts, you still have a single operative plan.
Only in Area A.
Sorry?
It only applies in Area A, though.
Well, no, as I say, sir, I respectfully suggest...
Well, yes, you have one operative plan, but it's in two parts.
Yes. Mm. And that decision is based on it's a usability-based decision in terms of the way that those operative chapters, there will be difficulties in integrating those into, let's call them the Part A chapters. It doesn't necessarily mean they're a different beast. They are historical, but I mean, this sort of thing happens all the time in terms of plans. They do become an amalgam of different drafting styles, and it's a natural consequence of a decision to exclude parts of the operative plan from this review, that they remain operative and be joined by parts of the proposed plan as they come along. So my submission to you is that there should be no legal significance of the physical separation into an A and B, certainly as far as those strategic chapters are concerned, and that they were expressly, and they do on their face apply on a district-wide basis, notwithstanding their location as part of Volume A.
Okay. I just had in mind the situation that the former Auckland City had with three parts to its district plan that separated by geographic areas. They didn't. If there were definitions, etc., and various parts that needed to be the same in each, they were repeated in each, so that one could pick up the part for geographic area A and know that you didn't have to look somewhere else. Isn't the intention then of the council to, at the time at which the strategic directions chapter become operative, make them clearly part of the Volume B documentation, so the people who are under the zoning in that area know that they will become subject to those objectives and policies? I raise this on because I'm not sure that people in those areas had that expectation of those submissions. That's what concerns me.
Well, certainly the public notice in terms of stage one of the review was sent as required.
Right.
And applies to all landowners and ratepayers. And in terms of the wording of those strategic chapters, I do recall having an exchange with you during the course of that hearing that they were expressly district-wide
yes.
chapters, and it was a district-wide strategic approach.
So we should feel reasonably assured that there was an expectation of everyone that they would apply, and then the subsequent exclusion which occurred post-notification didn't remove their ability to submit on those chapters.
Yes, well, certainly based on my understanding of case law, I think it was they would have had a reasonable appreciation that the district-wide chapters, the strategic chapters were district-wide. That was evident from their face. And people who perhaps were uncertain about exclusions or indeed the content of stage two could still have submitted on those matters if they reasonably considered that they were likely to be affected by them. So in my submission, the panel can have some confidence that there's no perceived unfairness as a consequence. Certainly except it's not particularly tidy and has with the benefit of hindsight, probably some of the decisions wouldn't be made again in terms of the structure and content. Staging does create some complexities, but in my submission, no reasonable basis for concerns about unfairness.
Well, the only one that I suppose the one area I'm concerned about is the PC50 area, because you say in footnote 14 that the only exception to the strategic chapters covering all the district is PC50, because it withdrew it in state law. And if I recall the timing, I can't. That was before further submission, you said?
Post notification and post first round submissions. Yes. Yeah, look, I.
And that. I wonder if the effect of that too was to withdraw submissions that may well have been. I think that might require some further attention from the council.
I think you're right, sir. Just rereading that footnote, and again, in terms of the position I relate to you, I'm not sure if that comfortably with what I relate to you. And as a matter of logic, it would be difficult to regard one exclusion in terms of the operative plan as being distinctly different from another excluded area. Certainly. Approaching from a strategic point of view. I think the end result of PC50 sits entirely comfortably with the overall strategic approach in terms of town centre consolidation and function issues. So yes, I think we will come back to you on that and certainly raise that with officers.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Sorry, sir, just to add to that, in the same way that there's no resolution of council which says this is how we're going to interpret the plan, This footnote, I suspect, is not covered by a resolution in terms of interpretation either, so it can be clarified from interpretation.
Well, I think that would be helpful to actually see what the wording of the resolution was, so that you advise how that strictly applies. And I presume that in terms of the areas that the council resolved to exclude from the district plan, which they will subsequently withdraw, they will resolve to withdraw any provisions from the proposed plan, so that we have the appropriate wording in place.
Yes, and those integration issues are complex. And the officers need to be mindful of that as we work our way through the process.
Yes, and presumably that then some consistency will occur with all of those areas.
Yes.
Yes. I just wondered in paragraph 14, it suggested that if there was a further withdrawal, we might think there would be a need for a variation as well. And I just wondered if both are required, or whether withdrawal in terms of the first schedule allowed remove the requirement to vary as well.
Yes, well, I mean, that will depend upon the specific change which is needed and whether it will be surgical or whether it's rather more complex than that. In some instances, a straight withdrawal then can be a problem with provision. It may impact how it's intended to apply.
Yeah.
It's designed which it is intended to cover. So, I just have to say that we're rather hedging our bets there depending upon the detail.
In terms of the next section on the clarification of the applicability and changes to volume B that are required, does council have any idea of the timing if that's likely to occur? It probably applies also to the withdrawal matters.
I'm not aware of specific times here. I'll take instructions and revert to you on that.
Yes, I'm just mindful that some of the matters that have resolved to be excluded, which need to be withdrawn, have effects in the planning, the mapping hearings, and it would be quite good if the surgery could be undertaken after those commencements.
Well, that's right, sir. We don't necessarily want to take up your time with getting the benefit of the game to disappear, so bear that in mind.
In paragraph 17 and 18, we're talking about signs and earthworks chapters. Would there be the possibility that they could be incorporated into stage one as a variation? Given that stage one has referred to them as relevant chapters, they've both been made operative relatively recently, and the only intention of the council is to change the chapter number and the rule numbers and the internal references.
It's certainly possible to do that. As to whether it's, there are some sort of reasons in terms of resourcing, time, and those sorts of things.
The reason I ask it is because if they could be made, if they were a variation, then they would reach same stage as stage one much faster, even which has implications, particularly with earthworks and the subdivision chapter.
Yes, from that's a good point to take instructions on that. But as you say, the relationship is mentioned in the chapters that you are dealing with. So I don't think there'd be any scope issues or constraints in terms of the ability to initiate a variation.
I see it. I see it as distinct from the transport chapter, where there's probably going to be major changes to what it actually says and relates to. But I think these two are...
Yes, they're quite discreet, and to the extent they're reasonably well seasoned and quite new, then the ability to integrate them may be more straightforward. Well, as I say to you, I'm happy to take instructions on that and perhaps come back to you for the end of the council's presentation at this hearing.
I'll come back to that after, at the end. What's your paragraph 24 dealing with the clause 16? Brackets 2, that is. I'm wondering whether the council resolving to make those amendments now might actually be just create more work for the hearing panel, because we have to go back through our reports and make adjustments, or whether a memo setting out all the matters in terms of submissions that could be dealt with that way, we may have already identified some of them in any event, and then the council could resolve in making the decisions on our recommendations to make those corrections at the same time.
In terms of text of the provisions that might work?
Yes, there's the text ones in particular I was thinking of. Yes,
I see. Yeah. I think the framing ones possibly may need to be done in advance, could be separated into two sections. Possible changes, but I'll grab that indication
I'm just concerned we may have recommended some of those changes, and we may have completely rewritten areas that don't require change.
Of course. Just from an efficiency point of view, there's a logic to that. I'll take instructions on that as it's growing.
Then my final request rather than question in terms of the maps, and if the council was to do clause 16.2, the amendments on maps would be even more important. The panel is wondering whether, as a result of the exclusion of various areas and those amendments, whether before we get to the mapping hearings we could have an updated set of maps that does not include the operative zones.
Grey out.
I like white.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely nothing. Yes. That I think that will assist us greatly when it gets to the mapping hearings.
Yes. All participants on the final report.
Overall, the memorandum is helpful in setting up where the divisions are. Clearly, the submitters need to be given some clarity on what's happening, and it, probably the council's role should do that rather than the panel's. And it may be that the memorandum is not. Well, there are a few matters that need to be dealt with, but it may need to be done in a way that is directed to the submitters rather than the panel, so that the submitters take appropriate notice of the situation.
I understand what you're saying, sir. Possibly some of the content of the PNCM could be simplified.
Yes, but also, and as I made clear, that these pieces are in and these pieces are out.
Yes.
Things such as listing the changes, we all know what they are, but your average submitter possibly be helpful if the map show the bits that have been excluded.
Thank you, sir.
I asked all the hearing commissioners for their comments for me to construct my questions on. So that is the questions of all the panel.
Thank you. On the memorandum.
Yes.
That helps, thank you. Well, that being the case, shall we commence on the business owners' legal submissions. I understand they were filed on Friday afternoon and not expecting the spirit of the panel to have a chance to approve them.
Oh, how classical. I had a very busy weekend.
Yes. All right, well, what I'll do, sir, or what I propose to do in the usual manner is work my way through them. I'll identify parts that can be taken as read. What I would say is that the intention is to highlight contentious issues. There should be a reasonably strong alignment between the legal submissions and summaries of evidence that we've had. And really is intended to be a roadmap for specific issues during the course of the hearing. So, starting at page one, I'll take the entirety of that introductory section as really that is scene setting, simply notes, and I will take you through in further detail. The subject matter of the submissions is set out in paragraph 1.7. Those headings will match up as we work our way through. And starting at section 2, strategic overview of business chapters. The starting point for the council's overall approach to business activity is the strategic direction chapter 3 that sits over the proposed district plan as a whole. And indeed, we've had a discussion as to the intention ultimately that it sits over the entire plan itself. This chapter provides a high-level policy framework setting out the overarching strategic direction for the management of growth, land use and development, and then it ensures the sustainable management of the district's special qualities. Under the strategic approach, the Queenstown and Wanaka town centres are the hubs of New Zealand's premier alpine resorts and the district's economy. The planning framework is intended to enable quality development and enhancement of the Queenstown and Wanaka town centres as key commercial, civic and cultural hubs of the district. Commercial rezoning that could undermine the role of those centres is to be avoided. The strategic direction chapter promotes growth in the visitor industry, providing for tourism, also providing for a wide variety of activities and sufficient capacity within commercially zoned land to accommodate business growth and diversification, enhancing the mixed-use function of the Frankfurt commercial area, and recognising the contribution made by Queenstown Airport to the district. The chapter also promotes urban development in a logical manner that promotes a compact, well-designed and integrated urban form and urban areas that are desirable and safe places to live, work and play. The individual business focuses provide further insight into how the overall strategic approach flows through to the business chapters. The recommended purposes of the respective zones are as follows. First, reviewing the town centres. All of the town centres' purposes include to provide a focus for community life, retail, entertainment, business and services, and provide a vital function for serving the needs of residents and as a key destination for visitors to the district. High visitor flow significantly contributes to the vibrancy and economic viability of the centres. Specific to each centre, the Queenstown Town Centre provides a diverse range of visitor accommodation and visitor-related businesses and tourism activities and serves as the principal civic centre for the district. Over time, it is intended to become an increasingly dynamic and vibrant town centre to continue to offer a wide range of activities and will evolve into a higher intensity and higher quality urban centre. The Wanaka Town Centre will serve a growing resident population and visitor numbers, for which it plays a vital role as a focal point for community activities and amenities. It will be large enough to provide a range of retailing, business and entertainment options, yet remain compact so as to be accessible on foot. And the Arrowtown Town Centre, its special heritage character attracts those visiting the district, and the Town Centre provides business and retailing for local residents at a boutique scale. The centre will serve a growing resident population and visitor numbers and will continue to be a focal point for community activities and amenities. Its compact form enables people to access the town centre on foot. Links and pathways facilitate the movement of pedestrians. Turning to local shopping centres, they are intended to enable small-scale commercial and business activities in discrete pockets of land that are accessible to residential areas and people in transit. The zone seeks to reduce the necessity for people to travel longer distances to town centres to purchase convenience goods and access services. The intention for the business mixed-use zone is to provide complementary commercial, business, retail and residential uses that supplement the activities and services provided by town centres. Higher density opportunities close to employment and recreational activities are also enabled. I think that's... should say high eventual density residential opportunities. And finally, turning to the Queenstown Airport mixed use zone, which is recommended to be renamed the Airport Zone. Its intention is to provide for a range of airport and airport related activities at Queenstown and Wanaka airports and to recognise the unique role of the airports in providing for the social and economic well-being of the community. It is evident from the respective zone purposes that the retail and commercial centres of the district have different roles. The Queenstown and Wanaka town centres are destinations in their own right and are central to the growth of tourism, particularly Queenstown. Ensuring that they have capacity for further quality development is key to the continuing growth of the district's economy. Other major business areas of Queenstown and Wanaka house a mix of industrial activities and services and retailing. And due to the rapid population growth, it is important that these functions can continue to develop. Turning to the scope of this hearing, sir, the six chapters, including the definitions used within and submissions on them that are being considered in their entirety, are those just described in paragraphs 2.5 to 2.8. Specific provisions from PDP subdivision and noise chapters are also being considered in this hearing. I'll briefly outline those. In Appendix 1 to her Queenstown Town Centre Section 42A report, Ms Jones has recommended amending Notified Rule 12.5.11 to exempt noise from commercial motorised craft and to clarify that the more enabling limits related to music, voices and loudspeakers do not apply to the town centre transition zone. Flowing on from this, Ms Jones has also recommended consequential amendments to Chapter 36 for consistency. Appendix 2 to the Queenstown Town Centre 42A report contains a separate table listing six submitters and lodged submissions on Chapter 36 and were considered to be potentially affected by Ms Jones' recommended changes. These submitters received notice of the business hearing and provided and we're provided the opportunity to be heard. Mr. Kyle from Queenstown Airport Corporation has recommended the inclusion of a new rule in the local commercial service zone that would implement the mechanical ventilation requirements proposed in Hearing Stream 5 for the non-complying activity states for breaches and that activity states arise between Stage 5. Ms. Bovies accepts this change and it is noted that a subsequent amendment will likely be required to Chapter 36. Given subdivision amendments, provisions from Chapter 27 related to minimum lot size and or density and submissions on them were deferred from Hearing Stream 4 to other zone-specific hearings so that those submissions could be considered alongside the standards of the respective zones. This approach was described in the Subdivision Section 42A report and opening legal submissions to the Council at the subdivision hearing and confirmed in the panel minutes dated 22 September 2016. Those submissions were received specifically seeking to amend the minimum lot sizes or density provisions related to the business chapters and therefore no changes were recommended through the relevant Section 42A reports. The business mixed use zone is the only business chapter zone that has a minimum lot area standard at 200 square metres. And finally, dealing with Watford Airport, Appendix 2 to the Airport Zone Section 42A report contains a separate table listing the submissions on Wanaka Airport that have been transferred from Hearing Stream 2, the rural hearing stream, into this hearing stream. All of these submissions have been considered in the context of recommending an airport zone for Wanaka Airport. With your leave, sir, members of the panel, I'll take paragraphs 4.1.3 is read. I will deal with the implications of these as they relate to specific areas of submission, dealing first with transport. A number of submissions were received on transport issues with respect to the Queenstown Town Centre, Wanaka Town Centre and the Airport Zone chapters. The Council has distinguished between these as follows. First, submissions on non-district plan related transport matters, which have been treated as not on the proposed plan and therefore out of scope. And secondly, submissions on transport matters that the Council considers to be most appropriately dealt with through Stage 2 of the proposed plan. Submission points falling into this class have been rejected on the basis that they are better considered when the transport chapter is notified. These submissions will not be transferred over to Stage 2, but submitters have the opportunity to resubmit on transport issues when the transport chapter is notified. Ms. Jones and Ms. Holden have also considered some transportation issues in their Section 42A reports on the Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres and Airport Zone chapters, limiting to their discussions to those submissions which are directly on objectives and policies in the notified chapters. Submitted evidence has requested that the issue of public transport via passenger ferry should be considered in this hearing rather than with other transportation issues. The Council's position is that dealing with transportation in a fragmented manner is unlikely to achieve integrated management of the district's transport network, and it's more appropriate to consider all transportation matters together when the transport chapter is notified in Stage 2. Turning to Section 42A recommendations which are outside the scope of submissions made on these chapters. The decision maker is limited to making changes within the scope of the submissions made on the proposed plan. The report authors have identified a number of provisions in the business zone chapters that they consider on the merits would benefit from improvements. However, even when taking a generous view, it appears that there may not be scope to address these issues within the scope of the submissions received from the business chapters. In these instances, the report authors have provided their views on the merits of certain changes, but have noted that there is unlikely to be scope to make them, and therefore that the changes are not included within the original chapters.
Mr. Winchester, I think on that point I should let you know that the panel is considering that once it's completed here all the text, it also has a number of matters which it considers their merit be changed. There's no scope for. And my information at this stage is for us to issue a minute advising the council of those matters, and so the council could incorporate at that time and then deal with them as it sees fit, its own matters that it's raised.
Thanks for the invitation, sir. That's no surprises. We can't wait for these documents issues crop up. So I think that's a certainly a constructive approach, and one that lots of people appreciate. The council has identified instances where submitters are seeking relief and evidence that is not within the scope of submissions made on the business checklist. The changes sought in evidence are not considered to be ones which are raised by and within the ambit of laws fairly and reasonably raised in submissions, nor are the amendments sought with foreseeable consequences of the relief sought in the submission. So the key point there is that you can't create scope out of evidence. As previously submitted to the panel, and putting the matter of collective scope and panel recommendations to one side, to the extent that the submitter has not sought relief in their submission and or has not made a further submission on specific relief, it is submitted that the submitter cannot advance relief solely through evidence.
I just wonder on that point though whether an expert is constrained to the scope of his client's submissions, or an expert can consider the matter in the whole and recommend changes that may be within scope for some other submission.
Yes, and I think we've recognised that when I said putting to one side issues of collective scope and panel recommendations, and there are several instances where consultants have taken a holistic view and looking at other submissions' cases and providing an expert view, and there's certainly no suggestion that there's any constraint on the panel receiving that evidence. And if there was scope somewhere, then there's scope.
Yes.
But we're dealing with discrete areas where on the report orders analysis there is no scope and yet the evidence goes a step further. So
I understand that distinction. Yes.
But you're quite correct, sir. And in many instances it's useful for the panel to have the evidence from that expert, irrespective of whether the specific client has raised the issue. And there's no constraint on the expert giving that evidence.
Mm. Of course it's helpful if the expert tells us on what scope it's relying.
Sometimes maybe asking too much, sir, but
yeah.
Anyway, no, fair observation. Moving on to the airport zone, in terms of Wanaka Airport, the evidence provided by Mr. Hunt for RPL and Mr. Day on behalf of QAC addresses the fact that the noise limits contained in Notified Rule 36.5.2 and Notified Rule 17.5.6, which apply to the Queenstown Airport zone, are more lenient than those that apply to other zones in the district. Dr. Charles addressed this issue in his evidence on Chapter 36 in Hearing Stream 5 and addresses it as again in his evidence summary to be presented at this hearing. Dr. Charles' view is that there is no justification for the noise limits of the Queenstown Airport zone being more lenient than for other zones. However, Ms. Holden has not been able to identify a submission on Notified Rule 36.5.2. Notified Rule 17.5.6 will be issued more generally. Accordingly, it's the position of the Council that there is no scope to remove the noise standards that apply to Queenstown Airport. Mr. Kyle has provided evidence for QAC on the proposed one at the airport zone and has questioned the scope to introduce the proposed limited activity status for airport and airport-related activities set out in proposed Rule 17.4.11 and 12. QAC did not seek specific relief in terms of a permitted activity status for airport and airport-related activities. However, the council submits that QAC's submission requesting bespoke provisions for Wellington Airport is broad enough to provide scope for the inclusion of the rules. The provision of a permitted activity status for airport and airport-related activities falls reasonably within the general relief sought, being provision for airport and airport-related activities at that location. Turning to Queenstown Town Centre, Ms. Black for Real Journeys and Town Art Investments, Mr. Farrell for Wellstart Investments appear to have recommended changes outside the scope of their respective client submissions. In their submission, Real Journeys Limited did not raise any concerns about the activity status in notified Rule 12.4.3 and has submitted Ms. Black as no scope to seek the amendments to that aspect of the rule. Further, nothing in the submission provides scope for a new definition of interface activities as sought by Ms. Black. As notified Policy 12.2.5.2, the relief sought by the submitter was to replace strategic with comprehensive, which does not provide scope for Ms. Black to raise concerns about any divisions. And I should pause and say, submission there is of course subject to the interchange we've just had about scope if it is provided by other submissions. But in this instance, I don't understand that to be the case, but that might be a matter you can put to the respective report authors. Ms. Black's evidence is also on behalf of Town Hall Developments. The relief sought in that submission is more general, namely a separate chapter for surface water activities and specific provision for tourism activities. Town Hall Developments did not seek a particular activity status or specific amendments to any of the notified tourism related provisions. Council understand that the submission by Mr. Farrell's client gives Mr. Farrell scope to consider changes to 65-67 Shotover Street and 5-15 Hay Street if any changes recommended in the Section 42A report constrained development on those sites. Ms. Jones recommends reducing the height limits in Rules P1 and P7. However, Mr. Farrell also seeks changes to notified policies 12.2.2.4 and 5, some of which do not relate to the submission. To turn to specific issues relating to town centres and scope issues here per se. First of all, comprehensive development plans in Queenstown and one of the town centres. Redrafted Rule 12.5.1 relates to maximum building coverage in the Queenstown Town Centre transition subzone and to comprehensive developments. The changes recommended by Ms. Jones will trigger the need to comply with a maximum coverage rule of 75% on all developments on a site or sites over 1,400 square metres in area. It would also be mandatory for any application for building within the Town Centre transition subzone or for a comprehensive development to include a comprehensive development plan for an area of at least 1,400 square metres. Ms. Jones considers these changes will more effectively implement the outcomes sought by notified objectives 12.2.2 and 12.2.4. Those objectives seek development that achieves high quality urban design outcomes and contributes to the town's character, heritage values and sense of place, and a compact town centre. For consistency, Ms. Jones has also recommended adding a new rule, 13.5.13, imposing the same maximum coverage rule for sites in the Wellington Town Centre. In recommending the above changes, Ms. Jones has relied on the evidence of Mr. Timothy Church, who supports requiring larger sites to be structure planned and provided analysis of property sizes to support the choice of the 1,400 square metre threshold. Ms. Jones agrees with Mr. Church that it would be useful in due course for the council to develop non-statutory design guidelines to assist in the preparation and assessment of both comprehensive development plans and smaller site-by-site designs beyond the SCA. It is submitted to be desirable to achieve consistency between Queenstown and Wanaka by applying the same rule in both centres.
Presumably there's scope to allow those changes the wife is housing there.
Yes, the architect's submission, my view. Turning to the issue of height limits in Queenstown and Wanaka, the issue of maximum height limits is an outstanding issue in both Queenstown and Wanaka town centres. These matters are considered in some detail in the evidence of the church, Ms. Dillies in relation to Queenstown, and Ms. Jones for the council. In relation to Wanaka, it is foreshadowed that Ms. Jones will recommend some further changes to the relevant provisions after considering the evidence of Ms. Wright for the Gen 8 Committee. Activity safety for buildings. Buildings throughout the Queenstown Town Centre are restricted to discretionary. A number of submitters requested that all buildings be controlled. Ms. Jones will present evidence that restricted discretionary status is more appropriate, as it will provide greater certainty and be more effective at requiring consistency with DSCA design guidelines and achieving quality architecture and urban design. Further, Ms. Jones viewed there will be economic benefits as relaxing the volume location control for existing media company. The operative plan will counteract the cost of obtaining restricted discretion consent. Regarding the urban design panel in Queenstown and Wanaka, Ms. Jones does not consider it appropriate to require mandatory review by the urban design panel of all new buildings and significant projects in the Queenstown Town Centre, but that this should be determined on a case-by-case basis. In her view, it may be sufficient at times for the Council to commission a review under Section 92 of the Act. Ms. Jones does not consider it would be effective to recommend a rule under which buildings that have been reviewed by the urban design panel have restricted discretionary status, noting that the mere fact the proposal has been taken to the panel would not mean that the proposal required a less rigorous assessment at the resource consent stage. And Ms. Jones takes the same view with respect to the use of the panel in the Wanaka Town Centre. Council's position with respect to use of the urban design panel remains the same as set out in the Council's submission as part of the residential hearing stream 6, namely that non-mandatory use of the urban design panel is adequate and that the current urban design panel process is functioning well and should remain voluntary. Turning to the issue of noise, alcohol and the entertainment precincts in Queenstown and Wanaka. The appropriateness of the proposed increased noise limits and the introduction of an extent of the town centre entertainment precinct is addressed in some detail by Ms. Jones in her evidence. In considering recommendations on this point, the council submits that the role of the town centre is important and that the proposed plan, as set out in the zone purpose, affords primacy for bars and restaurants over residential and accommodation within the zone. Key issues remaining are understood to be whether noise limits are too lenient or not lenient enough, and the boundaries of the town centre entertainment precinct. Council submits that the expert evidence of Dr. Charles on these limits should be relied on. Ms. Jones has recommended relaxing the activity status on licensed premises to control, but retaining the 11-year trigger for consent. The Council's position on the relationship between the RMA and the Sales and Supply of Alcohol Act is the same as the position taken by the Christchurch City Council at a recent hearing on the Christchurch Replacement District Plan. And that is the Independent Hearings Panel accepted that approach. The Council acknowledges that the Independent Hearing Panel's decision is not binding on this panel, but submits that guidance may be taken from it. The Council submits that the RMA and the Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act are complementary regimes with different purposes. The RMA plays an essential role in regulating a broader range of effects not covered by the Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act, for example, amenity-related effects such as noise and antisocial behaviour. Due to the different purposes of the two regimes, it is submitted that the Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act is not intended to replace the RMA in terms of regulation of environmental effects generated by licensed premises. Rather, several sections of the Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act suggest that the legislative regimes are complementary. The Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act contemplates some regulatory overlap with the RMA, and does not revisit the licensing process will replace provisions in planning documents with respect to damaging the effects of the sale of alcohol. Council therefore submits that RMA planning documents may contain provisions to manage effects of the sale of alcohol, so long as those provisions are for an RMA purpose. And finally, dealing with the Yarrowtown Town Centre, what I understood to be the key outstanding matters are very limited to the Yarrowtown Town Centre zone. Two matters relating to vehicular access to Buckingham Street and exemptions from maximum building heights for fire stations be addressed by Ms. Fobis. Dealing with the business mixed use zone, Speaker Bosch, seeks that the visitor accommodation be excluded from the business mixed use zone. Ms. Fobis rejected this relief in section 22A report due to the proximity of the business mixed use zone to the Wanaka and Queenstown town centres, the main tourism centres for the district. And with your leave, I'd like to delete the rest of that sentence and just bring in some replacement words, which should be, which are the district's two main hubs. For tourism activities.
Sorry, I missed four.
Tourism activities.
For tourism activities.
Just point two, the submission seeking to amend the activity status of visitor accommodation from restricted discretionary to controlled was accepted by Ms. Fobis. Finally, it is noted that Ms. Fobis rejected enabling industrial activities in the business mixed-use zone. In any event, the relevant submission points of Mitchell Dace Limited seeking this relief have been withdrawn. So the following issues also remain in dispute in the business mixed-use zone. First, should the building accession lines and notified rule 16.5.1 be relaxed to be applied at an angle of 45 degrees rather than 35 degrees as notified? And should a rule be introduced to set a minimum requirement for outdoor living space accompanying residential units? In relation to recession lines, Ms. Fobis relies on the evidence provided by Tim Church in recommending that the notified recession line rule is relaxed from 35 degrees to 45 degrees, but only if it is applied to the northern boundary of the site. In relation to outdoor living, rather than the inclusion of the new standard, outdoor living in conjunction with residential units is recommended to remain a matter of discretion for buildings, providing greater flexibility for the provision of outdoor space, including providing it communally. Mr. Church, however, is of the view that a minimum standard should be introduced. In addition to the zone-wide areas of disagreement for the business mixed-use zone located at Gorge Road, there remains a question as to the appropriate maximum building heights. Church supports the retention of the 12 metre permitted and 12 to 20 metre restricted discretionary maximum building height limits for the eastern side of Gorge Road, albeit with the exclusion of two sites. His view for the western side of Gorge Road and the east side exclusions is that the 12 metre permitted maximum height remains appropriate, but the restricted discretionary height limit should be between 12 and 15 metres for non-complying activity status applies. Ms. Fobis has balanced Mr. Church's views against other relevant matters and has recommended that there is no change to the maximum height limits at Gorge Road. She has, however, recommended additional measures of discretion to redraft Rule 16.5.8.1. The addition of a new rule requiring a set frontage for buildings exceeding three storeys, and an associated redraft policy in order to address Mr. and Mrs. concerns and surrounding matters of the similar issues exist for the business mixed-use zone as set out above under the town centre section with regard to the urban design panel and Ms. Fobis' recommendations are consistent with those Ms. Jones in that regard. Now, there are a number of issues relating to the local shopping centre zones, many of which relate to the type and scale of commercial activities enabled. Ms. Bowise has recommended changes to the activities enabled in the local shopping centre zone. The position reached by Ms. Bowise is supported by the evidence of Mr. Tim Heath, who is an experienced retail analyst. Mr. Heath has also provided evidence in response to the submission of Willow Ridge Developments Limited, who seek the introduction of the following controls in the local shopping centre zone. First, a restriction on retail activities to those providing a local service, and a maximum gross floor area of retail tenancies of no more than 400 square metres or rules to my consent. Mr. Heath has considered the zone objectives and policies to assist in his evaluation. If the zone seeks the enablement of people to purchase convenience goods and services without the requirements to travel potentially greater distances to larger town centres. He goes on to state that on a general level, the shopping centre zone purpose, objectives and policies are appropriately pitched to accommodate and facilitate the development of appropriate activity and tenancy types. However, in order to give further surety on development outcomes, Mr. Heath supported Willow Ridge's submissions in relation to outlining a maximum gross floor area for retail tenancies, specifically a proposed limit of 300 square metres per tenancy, and restricting some store activity types which are more suitable and aligned to larger town centres, being fashion stores, electronic and electrical goods stores, appliance stores, and furniture and floor covering stores. Mr. Heath also reviewed the zone provisions if they relate to 1 Hampson Road, more specifically where the notified rules provide for total gross floor area dedicated to retail uses not exceeding 4,000 square metres, no individual tenancy larger than 700 square metres, no more than 10 retail tenancies across the site in total, and total gross floor area dedicated to office users not exceeding 3,000 square metres. Mr. Heath's recommendations for the 1 Hampson Road site are to remove the 700 square metre threshold for individual tenancies and the limit of 10 tenancies for that site. His recommendations have been included in the revised chapter. Ms. Bowise considered Mr. Heath's evidence on the proposed GFA limit, and her opinion is that the limits on the GFA of office activities within the local shopping centre zone would give further effect to notified objective 15.2.1 and policy 15.2.1.2. In addition, she recommends that the limit of 200 square metres gross floor area for office activities suggested by Mr. Heath for 1 Hanson Road should be applied across the entire zone. In relation to restricting some store and activity types, Ms. Bowise adopts Mr. Heath's evidence as well as the notified definitions of retail sales, that retail sales, retailing, recreational activities, and residential activity, and considered that restricting the non-convenience retailing types of Mr. Heath will directly assist with ensuring the zone purpose is implemented and the notified objective. Associated policy are given effect. She therefore recommends this relief. The matter of height limits also remains in dispute at 1 Hanson Road, and you'll hear further from the witnesses, but I've set out in the table below what the recommended changes are, because there are several. You'll be able to ask questions of the respective experts on those matters. With regard to the local shopping centre zone, Cardrona Valley Road, Willow Ridge, opposed by the Gordon Family Trust, has also made a submission to reduce the size of the zone at Cardrona Valley Road. This component of the Willow Ridge submission has been deferred to the hearing on Magnet. As a further submitter seeking that the entire Willow Ridge submission be rejected, the Gordon Family Trust has lodged economic evidence of Mr. John Hockenhorn that seeks 2 larger tenancies, and this relief is within the scope of this hearing. Mr. Hockenhorn has provided evidence for the family trust recommending a range of activities in the zone, including larger tenancy caps and various types of retail. The evidence relies somewhat on the assumption that the size of the zone at Cadrone Valley Road will remain as notified. Therefore, the manual tenancy sizes cannot be completely removed from the size of the zone in that area. Mr. Heath has therefore been asked to consider Mr. Poppenhorn's evidence and will advise you of his views in summary. The Pinfold and Satomi Enterprises submission, where controls are sought in the zone as adjoining the submitter's land, is also specific to that zone and that location. This submission raises core lands that are intrinsically linked to the size of the zone, and there could be value in this submitter also being given an opportunity to be involved in the rezoning hearing. And just for completeness, similar issues arise down to the urban design panel and position is again consistent there. Moving to the airport zone, in particular one at the airport, Ms. Holden has recommended amendments to the airport zone charges to accommodate in the airport zone one at the airport. Backgrounds of the proposed airport zone at Wanaka is that the land at the airport was notified as part of the rural zone of the proposed plan. However, as part of the rural hearing stream of the proposed plan, the council considered the submission of Queenstown Airport Corporation that a bespoke planning framework be incorporated into the rural zone to provide for Wanaka Airport. In its legal submissions in the prior on the rural hearing, the council identified submission of QAC on the proposed plan provides scope for the development of a specific zoning for the airport. Panel subsequently directed QAC to transfer the submission to this hearing stream and provide draft provisions for the specific zoning of the airport. QAC and the council's planning experts worked together to prepare a draft set of provisions for the rezoning of Wanaka Airport, which have been used as the base for the Section 42A recommended chapter. The Council is grateful to QAC for its assistance in the drafting of the proposed airport provisions. So the position we've reached is that provisions are proposed to be included in the airport zone to accommodate airport and airport-related activities as permitted activities at Wanaka Airport. Standards are proposed to apply to ensure appropriate level of amenity is retained within surrounding zones and to ensure that any airport-related activity supports the functioning and viability of the airports and core airport activities. The Council's position is that the recommended airport zone at Wanaka is more appropriate than the notified rural zoning of the airport. The evidence Mr. Craig Barr presented in Hearing Stream 2 is that the purpose of the rural zone is fundamentally different to the nature and scale of activities at Wanaka Airport. The Council holds two designations that provide for airport activities at Wanaka Airport. However, the notified position was that where the Council does not have financial responsibility for the work, use of the airport would have to comply with the incompatible underlying rural zoning. The Council's position is also that the recommended airport zone is more appropriate than a bespoke planning framework for Wanaka Airport within the rural zone. The Council accepts that the creation of a framework for development and use of the Wanaka Airport within the notified rural zones would be likely to create significant inefficiencies in the interpretation and administration of the proposed plan. Further, it could result in inconsistencies as resource consent applications would be assessed against the rural zone objectives and policies which do not anticipate airport activities of this nature. The proposed express provision for airport and airport-related activity as part of the proposed Wanaka Airport zone is a significant change in the activities anticipated by the proposed rural zone provisions. However, the Council has provided a comprehensive Section 32AA assessment on the proposed Wanaka Airport zone provisions and concluded that the inclusion of the proposed airport zone provides firstly better guidance for decision makers, secondly, better alignment with the strategic direction components of the proposed plan, provides greater certainty for those seeking to develop airport activities, greater integrity to the rural zone by reducing the number of non-compliant resources for seeking to develop airport activities, and finally, it provides for reduced potential for unintended outcomes. On this basis, it is the Council's position that subject to further refinements recommended by Ms. Holden, the proposed Wanaka Airport zone provides the most appropriate framework for activities at Wanaka Airport. Turning to Queenstown Airport, the provisions contained within the Queenstown Airport zone provide for airport and airport related activities to be carried out at Queenstown Airport. Standards apply to manage the effects on the amenity values as a result of activities carried out at the airport. Notified Rule 17.5.7 of the Airport Zone Chapter requires hazardous substances to be used, stored and transported in accordance with the regulations made under the Hazardous Substances and Organisms Act and any Civil Aviation Act requirements. Any evidence on this holding is that the references are unnecessary and should be removed. As a matter of law, the HAZMAT regulations and the CAA requirements apply to the management of hazardous substances, regardless of any reference contained in the proposed plan. On this basis, the Council's position is that the references should be removed. Marples Parkland opposes the extent of activities provided for by the airport zone on land outside the operative Queenstown Airport mixed-use zone. Submissions on the proposed boundary of the zone will be considered in the rezoning hearings. However, the extent of activities provided for is a matter for this hearing. RPL submits the impact of further commercial expansion at the airport on Queenstown Town Centre were not considered in the Section 32 report. The likely extent of non-airport commercial activity at Queenstown Airport was, however, addressed in the designations hearing. Specifically, Mr. Kyle gave evidence that the limited land available for airport use at Queenstown Airport means that the potential for the establishment of commercial activity that is not central to the operation of the airport is low. RPL further submitted that the Section 32 report on the airport zone failed to consider all other reasonable alternatives for addressing the resource management issues identified in the report. Specifically, RPL submitted that the Council did not consider zoned activities on adjoining land that would be conveniently located for airport users. Ms. Holden accepts that the process of looking outside the zone was not carried out as part of the Section 32 assessment for the airport zone chapter. However, she wishes to hear the evidence for QAC and RPL before providing a view on the merits of the issue. Although the extent and location of the airport zone is a matter for the rezoning hearings, the evidence from Mr. Sargent on behalf of RPL is that the Council should have considered the option of extending the airport zone over parts of the Frankton Flats Special B Zone or the Remarkables Park Zone. This position, however, appears to be at odds with RPL's clear position presented during the course of hearings on the proposed plan, that both the Remarkables Park Zone and the Frankton Flats Special B Zone be excluded from the District Plan Review in their entirety. The effect of the exclusion of the RPZ and the Frankton Flats B Zone from the proposed plan of the Council does not have the option of rezoning this land. The Council has also resolved to exclude these two areas from Stage 2 of the proposed plan and include the two operative zone chapters in a Volume B of the District Plan that includes geographic areas of land not included in this review process. Finally, on this matter, Mr. Hunt has given evidence on behalf of RPL and expresses concern that redrafted Rule 17.5.7.1, which provides for visitor accommodation within the air noise boundary at Queenstown Airport, does not adequately manage noise effects. The evidence of Dr. Stephen Charles of the Council on this matter is that short stay visitor accommodation within the airport zone can be appropriately designed to mitigate noise effects. On this basis, the Council's position that the provision for visitor accommodation in the airport zone is acceptable. However, Ms. Holden has recommended that it would be more appropriate, to include additional controls limiting the provision of outdoor amenity spaces. There now interpretation drafting matters, first of all demolition of buildings. During the residential hearing, the panel questioned the approach taken to demolition of buildings. Similar to the residential chapters, the business and rural zone rules are silent on demolition. demolition is only specifically covered in chapter 26, and the building is a listed heritage item. As there are no specific rules for demolition of buildings in the business chapters, the activity would fall to the default activity status being permitted, except in the case of the recommended Wanaka Airport zone, where the activity status would be non-compliant. If considered necessary, the council would need to specifically include demolition as an activity in the temporary activities chapter in stage 2 in order to include a specific activity status into the proposed plan.
I just note, I think that is probably the better approach given that there would be non-compliant all the rural zones as well.
No, that's right, and there is an issue there in terms of the, I suppose, the drafting approach to those zones is quite different.
It seems ironical that a building can be a restricted discretion when it's knocked down as non-compliant.
That's right. Yes, particularly that's not a heritage item. In terms of the list of documents incorporated by reference, during the course of the residential hearing, the panel asked the council whether it would be appropriate to include a list of all documents that are incorporated by reference into the plan. The council confirms that this suggestion is sensible, although the list will need to be confirmed following panel recommendations on all chapters. The public notice for notification of stage 1 lists the documents that were incorporated into the proposed plan under section 300, so clause 342C of the first sheet of the RMA. Council's recommendations, as presented through previous hearings, such as subdivision, mean that the list will need to be updated. An update of this can be provided in hearing stream 10. It is also noted that the Council's legal right to reply for the strategic directions hearing addresses incorporation by reference.
Just on you've said hearing stream 10, perhaps the appropriate stream. I used to use that one. Yes, because in association with considering the definitions, which I think is 10, isn't it?
Yes, the intention, sir. Then the plan is under subheading clarification. In previous hearings, including rural and district-wide, the panel questioned the status of provision under the heading other provisions and rules, specifically within subheading clarification. To provide more certainty as to the regulatory status of these provisions, the council suggested in the residential hearing these clarification provisions should be further reordered under additional subheadings, general rules and advice notes. These changes do not affect the regulatory impact of these provisions and are considered to be non-substantive. Similar changes need to be made to chapters that have already been heard by the panel. The same approach has been followed in the recommended revised business chapters attached to section 42A reports by placing clarification provisions under the subject of general rules and advice notes. For completeness, it is noted that changes have also been made to the proposed plan explanatory table to align with other chapters. And just by way of update, dealing with matters that have arisen with notification of the plan and during the course of preparation of the 42A reports. Firstly, the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity. This was gazetted on the 3rd of November and comes into effect later this week. Queenstown is categorised as a high-growth urban area under this NPS, and therefore all objectives and policies in the NPS will apply to this council. The NPS includes a number of matters that local authorities must action. These are set out in legal submissions as part of the council's right of proposal for the residential hearing stream. At the time of making its recommendations on the proposed plan, the panel will need to give effect to the relevant objectives and policies of this national policy statement. Given, however, the novelty of the NPS and the complex and interrelated strategy for implementation that will need to be developed, the council is not yet in a position to address the panel on the consequences of those objectives and policies. It's noted, however, that the NPS defines development capacity in relation to both housing and business land, and also defines business land as land that is zoned for business uses in urban environments, including land in commercial, retail, business centres, and mixed-use zones. The NPS will therefore be directly relevant to business chapters. The Council has initiated a program of work in order to consider the requirements set out in the NPS on a comprehensive basis, as required by Section 55 of the RMA, and the timeframes set out in the NPS. In light of the above, the Council has not attempted to address the implications of the NPS or the proposed plan on a piecemeal basis. For that reason, the Section 42A reform rules for the business zones chapters have not provided evidence on the implications of the NPS for each of these specific chapters at this stage. The Council respectfully requests that it be afforded the opportunity to provide the panel with evidence on the implications of the NPS for Stage 1 of the proposed plan as a whole at a later date. That's high penitentiary on the Council's program, which is still being formed, and certainly I think it would be right towards the end of the hearing screens, possibly in the same discrete hearing. And the reason for
that... sometime like this time next year?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I was just trying to get a handle on whether it would be before the mapping hearings or...
I think after the mapping hearings, and possibly aspects of the mapping hearings would need to have regard to the work that was ongoing, I think.
I'm just wondering whether the mapping hearings in relation to the Queenstown area and then the Waitapu Basin, whether there should be something at least on the residential capacity available at that stage, because that's a major consideration that we have to deal with in the submission raised anyway.
Yes, it is, and prior to the NPS becoming gazetted, there was already some additional work underway in terms of the Waitapu Basin study and the associated data gathering analysis, which is underway, and that aligns pretty closely with what appears to be the direction from the NPS. The issue will be the extent to which that work is in a position to enable the Council to fully comply with its obligations under that NPS. But we will keep the panel advised of that. It's just not clear at this stage whether we will need to be possibly just a supplementary hearing to deal with any outstanding members. And the final issues here is to deal with the proposed regional policy statement. And as we've covered previously, the Regional Council has issued a public notice for the decision to be made on submission on the proposed RPS for Otago. And the Environment Court has extended the date for filing of appeals on the proposed RPS to the 9th of December 2016. As noted in the Council's grant of reply to the residential hearing and in accordance with the panel's minutes of 7 October, the Council will be filing a written submission and possibly filing further planning evidence if necessary on the applications of the RPS for the chapters of the proposed plan that have already gone to the hearing. After the content and scope, and any appeals on the decision's version are known. In respect of the business chapters, the implications of the decision version of the proposed RPS are addressed in the Council's evidence. And as I've advised you previously, there's one change proposed in terms of the order, which is switching around Mr. Swinney and Ms. Gillies. So those are the legal submissions from Council, sir. And I'm happy to answer any questions or if there are no questions, start with the witnesses.
Mr. Rogers.
No.
don't look on the phone, thank you.
Just a couple of quick questions. In paragraph 516, this is dealing with the issue of the supply and sale of alcohol at the RMA. There seems to be an inconsistency for the provisions in terms of references of matters of discretion relating to matters of supply of alcohol. Are we to take from these submissions that it should not be a matter of discretion, but the council's policy on the supply of alcohol be considered, because that is a matter for the Act?
Well, that may raise the scope issues here in terms of further submissions.
Well, that may be that maybe that some can be dealt with and some can't. Yes.
And potentially the partial withdrawal if necessary in terms of this matter of discretion. There is a scope issue there, so there's no scope to remove the right of submissions.
So in paragraph 6.3, we talked about a mutual dash submission being withdrawn. Just at some stage you have a reference to that provided. I wasn't aware of that. The local shopping centre at One Hanson Road, and it's a more broad question that will need to go to the listeners as well, but in the context of the council's conclusions and its right of reply on chapter 3, that there be an integration of the Frankton commercial areas and that be recognised as for objectives and policies, whether in fact, and also looking at the actuality of what is in that zone at present, whether in fact it is appropriately zoned local shopping centre. And I wonder if that isn't a fundamental issue than the tinkering with One Hanson Road that the council witnesses might like to contemplate.
Yes, I don't understand it to be a rezoned submission, but I suspect that Mr. Heath has some very firm views about that. To the extent that you are interested in his opinion, he would furnish it subject to those scope issues.
Yes, well, that's why I'm raising it now, so he can think about it before I brought it on, but it seems ironic that on one side of State Highway, so you can have a supermarket and a large shopping centre, and almost directly across the road, there's a limitation on the size and scale of shops when the policy direction is to recognise the entire area as commercial potential.
Yes, and in terms of I suppose the concept of integration, the significance of that comes with and we're coming from
certain. The other query I had is in your reference to the pinfold is Satomi Enterprises, and it probably the other submission is whether you consider the directions are required from the panel for those submissions to be also considered in the mapping hearings.
Yes, I think they should be, sir. Yes. Just to say completeness and appears. The issue of the extent of the zone and the nature of the controls and the so inextricably linked, they do straddle both hearing streams.
It might be helpful if the council could draft up a list of the relevant submitters that they consider would be affected there.
So.
I think if the council is satisfied that we should deal with the matters before us at this point rather than deferring all of it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'll take the morning agenda now and then we can.
Thank you, sir.